let's move straight on to welcome and introduce to you Stephen Gross, who is a Jungian analytic psychotherapist in private practice. He teaches and supervises at WPF Therapy and other training organisations. He is particularly interested in the overlap between psychotherapy and literature, especially the works of Shakespeare and which he has published widely. His first play, some of you may have gone, Freud's Night Visitors, has been performed twice now at the Freud Museum. Please join me in welcoming Stephen Gross. Thank you.
Firstly, thank you, Ivan, and the Freud Museum for inviting me here. I should just say that because of time constraints, I've had to cut the paper down a little bit, and I've taken out the philosophy sections, which I think can be much better handled by the expertise of Brian McGee. So I just hope this doesn't leave the paper seeming too fractured. I've called it Freud and Wagner, Assault on Reason. And I want to begin by sharing two of my own experiences relating to both Freud and Wagner, both of which exemplify the themes of resistance and Jewishness, which will wind their way through this paper. For many years prior to my decision to train as an analytical therapist back in the early 80s, I had been intrigued both by the ideas as well as by the whole culture that had grown up around Freud and Freudianism in general. As W.H. Auden famously wrote, to us, he is no more a person but a climate of opinion. It should have seemed inevitable, therefore, that I would have chosen to have pursued a Freudian training. But no, what did I do? I chose to ally myself with Carl Jung instead. Jung, the only non-Jew in Freud's elite inner circle of analysts. How did I, an atheistic Jew, yes, but one like Freud himself, greatly proud of his Jewish cultural heritage, explain to myself such a choice, an act of virtual betrayal, or so it felt at one level. As we know only too well from our reading of Freud, our choices as well as our actions are overdetermined, subject to manifold forces and factors predominantly unconscious and well beyond the grasp of reason. My choosing a Jungian training was no exception, of course, but what became increasingly apparent to me over time was that in throwing in my lot with the Gentile Jung, I was resisting an even greater identity with my Jewish upbringing and religion by rejecting Freud as a great Jewish patriarch, symbolizing so much against which I'd struggled for most of my life. Over time, and especially over the last couple of years, I found myself moving slowly but perceptively closer to Freud, my adolescent insurrection having blown itself out, my resistance to theoretical pluralism having all but dissipated. I can now find inner space for both Freud and Jung, and others beside them. Jewish identity is no longer the issue, not here at least. I have, since my late teens, been a passionate devotee of classical music. My tastes have grown increasingly, and I blush to use the word now, Catholic, over the years, with an interest ranging from Monteverdi to Messiaen. However, of all the so-called great composers, there were two for whom I had nothing less than an antipathy. The first was Puccini, and the other was Richard Wagner. Now, as far as Wagner was concerned, I have to admit that I was never quite sure how much my seemingly intransigent resistance to his music was, as a Jew, due to his pernicious anti-Semitism and to the associations of that music, however historically validated or not, with Hitler and the Nazis. I feared his music was narcotic-like, malevolent and totalitarian, capable of taking over my mind and demanding total submission. I was that paranoid. And yet there was an ambivalence of which there was no trace with the wretchedly mawkish Puccini, whom I desperately continued to avoid. I had in fact seen many of Wagner's operas and sat through a complete cycle of The Ring. Was I playing with fire, conversing with the devil? I wasn't sure, but I was conscious of the ceaseless conflict within between attraction and resistance. Then sometime last year, I was listening to the Sigmund and Sieglinde duet from the Walküre when something suddenly happened, and I felt a freedom and a release within me that I'd never previously experienced whilst listening to Wagner. The conflict had suddenly and mysteriously resolved itself. The fear had gone. I no longer felt I had to protect myself from this profoundly unsettling yet beautiful music. Only time will tell now what effect this Damascene conversion will have upon me. At the time of writing this paper, I have to admit to being somewhat naive, to say the least, thinking about what was behind the pairing of Wagner with Freud. It is, of course, easier to identify differences between people than it is similarities, and Freud and Wagner may appear, perhaps initially at least, as no exception. Now, of course, as we can see from the title of the conference, that both were drawn to myth as a substructure of their work. But my thinking took a somewhat different course. Rather than tackling the issue of myth head-on, in regarding them as two of the towering icons of Western culture, I decided that for the purpose of this talk, I might approach them both as explorers of the unseen by way of an assault on reason. And so I shall attempt to cursorily outline the common binding that holds them in harness. Sigmund Freud set out on his great odyssey and remained so to the end as a proud descendant of the European Enlightenment, with his philosophic roots firmly grounded in the rationalist and empiricist orientation of Kant. Though he remained stubbornly resistant to acknowledging any major influences on his thinking, at least of all the philosophical, throughout that long and fertile life. Reflecting Kant's central concept of the noumenal, the thing in itself of which we can have no direct or unmediated knowledge, and which must remain an inferred reality postulated by reason, transcending experience and all rational knowledge. However, later on, Ludwig Binswanger was later to claim that Freud had once said personally to him, "The unconscious is metaphysic. We simply posit it as real." Whilst philosopher Alfred I. Tauber describes Freud as journeying from a postulated science of the mind to a humanistic inquiry of the soul. The young Freud set out fresh from his early work as both practitioner and researcher in neurology as a liberal-minded atheistic Jew to begin his investigation of hysteria in the spirit of positivist empirical science. Although there appears, to my knowledge, no record of Freud having read the Bavarian philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach, 1804 to 72, who, as we shall see, was to have such a powerful influence on the young Wagner, Freud's theory of religion as a universal expression of human needs and projected qualities echoed closely those of the older philosopher, and so establishes a link with the composer, both of whom were to become essentially Feuerbachians in their understanding of religion. By the time that the young Wagner was waging revolution alongside the anarchist Mikhail Bakunin at the barricades in Dresden in the late 1840s in their attempt to sweep away the evils of the world and build what Marx was later to call a socialist utopia, Wagner discovered the writings of Feuerbach, who was to prove such an influence on his thinking and on his work. The essence of Feuerbach's thought was that the liberation of mankind would only come into being through the full realization of human love. It was Wagner's assimilation of this basic notion upon which he constructed his entire Ring cycle, in which love is foregone in the pursuit of power and wealth, with somewhat cataclysmic results. Feuerbach's The Essence of Christianity, with its basic premise that the gods and all of mankind's deities are no more than men and women's own projected powers, so resonant with the basic contention of Freud, would come to determine Wagner's own understanding of religion for the rest of his life. It would be a revolution of love which would banish all of society's iniquities and bring with it true meaning into the lives of all. Feuerbach's ideas exploded the myth of a transcendental realm from a world where all that existed was man and nature. All that is can be seen by all. With the collapse of the insurrection in 1849 and the arrest of Bakunin, Wagner fled to Switzerland. Wagner had failed as political revolutionary without question, but he was about to bring about a pivotal revolution in music and in music drama. Freud, too, was to go on and bring about a revolution in human psychology in the way of self-knowledge. Like all successful revolutionaries, they succeeded in generating vehement resistance to their ideas. Tellingly, Freud regarded the hostile attitudes, especially towards his discoveries in exposing unconscious desires, and indeed towards his entire project as a whole, as itself an example of resistance to the threatened sovereignty of our rational ego consciousness. Could we not similarly regard the continuing deep-seated hostility to the works of Wagner? Indeed, no greater composer or indeed any celebrated creative artist has so polarized feelings as a further example of the resistance to which Freud refers. The core of such resistance, I believe, again unconscious, is to our exposure to that irrepressible timeless reality of the noumenal, itself seen and beyond the limits of rationality, that his music so inimitably expresses. Even before he reaches the metaphysical masterpiece, which is Tristan and Isolde, Wagner is already celebrating the joys of sibling incest in Die Walküre. A vital link between Wagner and Freud are the ideas of German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. It was in 1854, at the age of 41, that Wagner first encountered Schopenhauer through his reading of his magnum opus, The World as Will and Representation. This work especially, and the ideas of Schopenhauer in general, were to prove the greatest influence on Wagner, above all others, for the rest of his life, raising to consciousness ideas that until that point had been simmering, if only incipiently, at an unconscious level in his mind. He had, certainly since the Flying Dutchman opera, written in 1840, been preoccupied with the issue of redemption. Schopenhauer held that the only means of redemption for man was the annihilation of the will and the total self-abnegation, thereby releasing him from the onerous burden of egotism and engagement with the iniquities of the iniquitous social and material world. We may wish to consider here a comparison with Freud's notion of thanatos, perhaps better known as the death instinct. For Schopenhauer, life consisted of an endless striving, yearning, and desiring. Is it not something Lacanian here in this perception? He saw humankind as essentially selfish, stupid, and cruel. He was indeed the most pessimistic of philosophers, a pessimism that was to infect both Freud as well as Wagner in the view that each held the human condition. According to Schopenhauer, any direct access to the noumenal world is only possible to the mystic in the experience of sexual ecstasy, however transient that moment, and through the arts, none more so than music, which, as the one non-representational art form, serves as the very voice of the will that pervades all being. Whilst Wagner's grand project was to create opera as a total work of art, Gesamtkunstwerk, combining all of its elements into one integral music drama, giving equal weight to each, certainly by the conclusion of the Ring cycle, the influence of Schopenhauer was unmistakably reflected in the primacy to which Wagner had given to the music in conveying the metaphysical core of the operas. Wagner was not the first, nor was he to be the last great artist or thinker to recognise the limits of language to express profound truths. Words, words, mere words, no matter from the heart, in tones Troilus, in Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida. But if it is the case, as Schopenhauer claimed, that music of all the arts is that which most truly conveys this universal will underlying all appearances, and that it is Wagner's music above all others that best succeeds in this, there seems that there is a price that must be paid. That for some at least, it's too great, and that price is that of human reason, the faculty of rational thought and judgment. The music is experienced itself as irresistible, willful, and a seductive ocean of sound that overwhelms the listener's capacity for free and independent reflection. It asserts a totalitarian grip over the listener. The East German musician Paul Dessau said of Wagner, quote, "He was certainly a genius, but one at least that the GDR could do without." Because his work filled with opiates must not serve for the obfuscation of the brain. With this undermining of reason went Schopenhauer's rejection of the world, for certainly since the Enlightenment, reason was seen as man's primary faculty for engaging with and ordering the chaos of the world, as well as for giving meaning to his existence. Wagner, through his music and the inspiration of Schopenhauer, was insisting on something other. And this leads to the notion of civilization, and our return to Sigmund Freud. It was in 1930 that Freud's Civilization and its Discontents first saw the light of day. For Freud, as previously noted, was a sincere adherent to Enlightenment values, none more so than that of human reason, which he had maintained was mankind's only hope, and yet so ironically, perhaps, in his long exploration of the infinite mysteries and caprices of the unconscious, he was led increasingly to the realization that reason was of itself not sufficient to facilitate in human beings a morality that might provide a sufficient sense of both personal and collective well-being. What was required was nothing less than civilization, this vast and pervasive protective carapace against the anarchic human impulses of sexuality and aggression. The major instrument employed, according to Freud, by civilization to control these primitive and feral instincts was the installation of the superego or conscious as part of the human psyche. This internalization of the law with its weighted authority, while succeeding increasingly in assuming mastery over our human nature through an ethical self-control, induced in civilized man a neurosis as he fought to contain this internal struggle between the forces of life and death. One increasingly institutionalized expression of this conflict was the emergence of religion, with its marked emphasis on love as a means of combating our rapacious appetites, We were exhorted to love our neighbours ourselves and to turn the other cheek. Though Wagner, under the early influence of Feuerbach, believed throughout in the unchallengeable power of love, he, as of course did Nietzsche, decried Christianity, especially for alienating man from his instinctual life. Civilization, particularly under the influence of its most outspoken religions, essentially restricted all sexual life to heterosexual genital love, and only then the means for propagating the species. Tristan and Isolde is perhaps the most consummate example in all art, or certainly in music, of the attempted resistance of the sexual drives to the overwhelming repressive power of civilization, which there could only be achieved in and through death. Art itself, however, has become one of the primary means by which these aggressive and sexual energies have been channeled towards socially respectable ends. For Wagner, men and women have to rip away the mask of reason and civilization to realize their true inner selves, that great well of natural feeling and psychic energy that constantly clamored for liberty through myth, dreams, and symbols. Freud, the far more conservative personality, that most unnaturally revolutionary of men, had awoken the sleeping monster of the human unconscious, and if left uncontrolled, threatened to overthrow the rule of reason and civilization. But the genie was now out of the bottle. It would require the indomitable authority of law and the guilt-inducing inner voice of conscience to limit its destructiveness. I now wish to end with a question which I certainly felt hovered cloud-like over this conference. I think Tony at the start actually pointed up to this cloud, and I just want to expand on this a little bit. It's painful. It's a painful one, but it is an inescapable one, and it has been touched on by at least the previous speakers. How might we consider both Freud and Wagner, especially in relation to Nazism, and most particularly to the Holocaust? Certainly we must see the Jewish Freud as a victim of Nazism. His books were burned, he was forced to escape Vienna in fear of his life, while his sisters and other members of his family were consumed in the flames of Auschwitz. The sea of discontent of civilization of which Freud had warned had indeed burst its banks and engulfed for some time the plains of civilized Europe, the bastion of reason in which he had initially at least so much entrusted his hope for humanity had been peremptorily swept away in a huge torrent of unprecedented hatred, brutality, and wanton destructiveness. Was clearly no victim, or perhaps retrospectively it might be claimed that he had been made into one, the question of how much, if indeed any, responsibility Wagner may have had, however indirectly, for the rise and subsequent horrors of Nazism has not, and possibly will never, completely vanish. There are many, no doubt, here in this room, and I think Brian might be one of them, who, in total sincerity, would completely absolve Wagner from any historical part in the Nazi phenomenon. In fact, while some have seen him as a proto-fascist, others on the political left have even gone so far as to claim him as one of their own, recalling his early commitment to socialist revolution. And there has even been a Marxist reading of The Ring performed in Bayreuth. Nonetheless, however unjust and ultimately refutable, guilt by association can be very difficult to throw off. Wagner was unquestionably a vicious anti-Semite, a fervent German cultural nationalist, clearly reflected in Hans Sachs' appeal at the conclusion to Die Meistersinger, passionately adored by Hitler, who himself was adored by Wagner's daughter-in-law, Winifred, and was even hailed as early as 1934 in the Bayreuther Blätter by the German historian Hermann Seeliger as the direct forerunner of Hitler. And did not Leni Riefenstahl, the famous or infamous German filmmaker, name her best-known cinematic study of the Third Reich as the triumph of the will? In fact, as far back as the 1850s, the great German Jewish poet Heinrich Heine himself, on good terms, I believe, with Wagner, uttered this chillingly prescient warning. Kantians, Fichtians, and pantheistic philosophers of nature do not laugh at the visionary who anticipates that the same revolution will occur in the world of impressions as had already taken place in the world of mind and spirit. Thought precedes deed as lightning precedes thunder. Such a drama will take place on German soil that in comparison to the French Revolution will look like an innocent idyll. End of quote. Time, alas, has not spared Wagner such dark scrutiny. The distinguished contemporary Wagner scholar, Barry Millington, sitting here somewhere, in his recently published book, Richard Wagner, the Sorcerer of Bayreuth, writes, "For Wagner, Jewishness was a necessary evil, for without it one would be unable to define Germanness. Without the loathing of all things Jewish, the elevation of love as the central concept in Wagner's epistemology would never have gained the traction it did. Far from anti-Semitism being an unfortunate aberration, as many would like to believe, it should actually be regarded in Wagner's case as grist to the mill." He goes on, "The protectionists are happy to see Wagner the man vilified as an obnoxious racist, provided the works themselves come up smelling of roses. But the notion of such a firewall between the man and his works is a nonsense. Few composers, oeuvre, are as ideologically motivated as Wagner." Close quotes. He then goes on to soften his critique by reminding us that Wagner was merely expressing sentiments held widely in his time. It is not reasonable to hang the indictment of Nazi atrocities round his neck. Anti-Semitism is an intrinsic element of the Wagnerian world that gave us some of the greatest masterpieces of Western civilization, The Ring, Die Meistersinger, Parsifal. Close quotes. Civilization, however, for all its great masterpieces, came to an abrupt halt at the gates of Auschwitz. No great work of art could prevent the slaughter. The wild beast forever lurking deep within the human psyche had broken off the shackles of repression. Hamlet's satyr had overpowered his Hyperion. Reason, love, and language were all reduced to ash. No more poetry after Auschwitz, declaimed Theodor Adorno. Although he didn't, of course, talk of music, something perhaps to reflect upon. Following a momentous struggle, civilization, albeit in a somewhat new guise, managed to re-emerge phoenix-like from the ashes of Auschwitz. Richard Wagner was tainted for some beyond redemption by his association with the evils of Nazism. But he has emerged gradually since this cataclysm, despite the shadows, more revered and more often performed in the opera house than ever before. Sharing a bicentenary year with the liberal-minded and humane Giuseppe Verdi, few would contest the claim that here in the UK, at least, the German Wagner has been given pride of place in the celebrations. He even has the great German musician Daniel Barenboim promoting his cause in Israel, the home of so many victims and their descendants of the horrors of Nazism. Got it right that time. It would seem that the sheer power, profundity and beauty of his works have succeeded in eroding much of the resistance that it had once encountered. By contrast, the contemporary standing of Sigmund Freud, the alleged flag bearer for the sovereignty of human reason, is to say the least ambiguous. In many critical quarters, he's never been forgiven for confuting the conviction of the innocence of the child, and in laying emphasis on the supremacy of the unconscious over our conscious mind, and with it the undermining of human reason and the belief in freedom of choice. Thanks to Freud, man no longer felt master of his own house. Like Copernicus and like Darwin before him, Freud made us realise that we were less special as a species than we thought we were. Resistance to Freud, both in and out of the consulting room, remains at least as strong as it ever did. I would like to conclude as I began on a personal note. For most of the time whilst sitting at the computer working on this paper, I was playing the operas of Wagner, which almost throughout was accompanied by an underlying yet unshakable sense of guilt. However, the guilt was not due to the fact that I, after many years of quite principled resistance to the malevolent enchantment of this Jew-hating genius, had finally succumbed to his irresistible charms, but that I was merely using his great works as little more than background as I prodded away at the keyboard. What would any seasoned Wagnerian think of me if they were to know? I shudder when I imagine. The fact now remains that after so many years of struggling to resist the influence of both Freud and Wagner, paradoxically a resistance in both instances born to no little extent out of my sense of Jewishness, both Sigmund Freud and Richard Wagner sit comfortably together in my inner world, stirring it, exciting it, and most definitely enriching it. What would they have made of each other, I leave you all to contemplate. There is the offer of the ring, as Tony has pointed out. Does not the immense power that Richard Wagner's music continues to hold over so many, despite his unquestionable and equally unshakable association with evil, intimate a victory of the infinitely willful and irrational over the moral and rational self? As the Marxist literary theorist Terry Eagleton writes, once the will becomes all-powerful, reason ceases to be a moral faculty and finds itself reduced to instrumental status. It is now no more than a humble handmaiden of passion, interest and desire, close quote. A triumph of the will indeed. One last thought. If, as this conference has been considering, we've arrived at the end of myth, then one more recent example, that is, that a work of creation should always be considered morally distinguishable from its creator, has, I would claim, been disproved, perhaps emphatically in the case of Richard Wagner, and so too, if less obviously, in the case of Sigmund Freud. Before I finish, I would just like to read one of Shakespeare's sonnets, and it's number 147. My love is as a fever, longing still for that which longer nurseth the disease, feeding on that which does preserve the ill, the uncertain sickly appetite to please, my reason the physician to my love, angry that his prescriptions are not kept, hath left me, and I desperate now approve, desire is death, which physic did accept. Past cure I am, now reason is past care, and frantic mad with evermore unrest. My thoughts and my discourse, as madmen's are, at random from the truth vainly expressed. For I have sworn thee fair and thought thee bright, who art as black as hell, as dark as night. Thank you.